Hello and welcome to a very football-forward edition of the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy. But there's absolutely nothing to be afraid of here because we're going to meet some of the contributors to the recent Art of Football conference in Dublin, philosophers, critics and academics using their own special tools to discover what association football can tell us about time and space and beauty. And after all that, we'll turn away from the beautiful game and wander into the workshop of architect-turned-woodturner Alan Meredith. But football first, and the first name on the team sheet is a galactico of football philosophy, an author of What We Think About When We Think About Football, Simon Critchley. Critchley's book has become a key text for academics thinking about football, many of whom gathered at the recent Art of Football conference in Dublin, which is where Culturefile met with Simon Critchley to talk about meaning, time, beauty, and the essential weirdness of this being a conversation about football.
I'm an academic and I hate academic conferences and philosophy conferences made me want to shoot myself in the face. But the football conference that I went to a few years ago was fascinating because here were people that really knew about something. They were passionate about some aspect of football. It was the only conference I've enjoyed in decades.
From the people I've spoken to, that is quite familiar. Like, they've maybe even made a conscious effort, found themselves interested in football and made a conscious effort to bring it into their other work.
When I was doing my PhD in the 1980s, late 1980s, I wanted to dedicate it to Kenny Dalglish. My people in my department said this would be a ridiculous thing to do. I watched a lot of football and I'm a lifelong supporter of Liverpool Football Club. My family's from Liverpool. So it's a deep religious commitment to the team. But I was rather shameful about it for many years. It wasn't something you could talk about in polite company. And that's really changed. You can date it to things like the publication of Nick Hornby's Fever Pitch and books like that and the rise of kind of taking soccer, football much more seriously as a phenomenon. And then, you know, lo and behold, sometime later, you know, football has grown into this global sport, which is surpasses every other sport in influence.
Welcome to Fortress Anfield.
One of the things that you do talk about is that very kind of conflicted feeling that football can give you.
You cannot feel good about football. I think you can't just feel good about football. Football is the world at its best and at its worst. Football gives you an intense tribal sense of who you are, where you're from, which side you're on. And it gives you a history, it gives you a series of myths, of heroes, all of that. And that's what fan culture embodies, and it embodies that through song and through stories and through obscene jokes, and all of that is fantastic. It's a kind of, so football is a kind of a living archive, kind of a living memory. It's a way in which history impinges in the lives of people, brings them together in an extraordinarily vivid way, which is constantly changing, and that's great. On the other hand, what's making it possible is money, the movement of money. And often dirty money from sources that we can't check or we don't want to check. If you're a Manchester City fan or a Chelsea fan, or whatever it might be, or Paris Saint-Germain. So the sense in which football is our world. It's beauty, the beautiful game, as people say, without really knowing what that means. And it's our world at its ugliest at the same time.
So let's talk about the beauty of it. When people say the beautiful game, why do you say they don't know what they mean?
Well, it's just that thought isn't developed. It's just people say, oh, it's the beautiful game, and that's the kind of, yeah. For me, calling it the beautiful game is, well, what does that mean? So last night, Dalymount Park, we watched this documentary, Footballers Never Before, featuring George Best. And George Best was a beautiful man, a beautiful human being and a beautiful player. And there were, the film that was made in 1970 is eight cameras trained on George Best for 90 minutes of a game, Manchester United against Coventry. That's it. And you're just looking at him move, walk, hold his back. And I got to that film through another film, which was a kind of remake of the George Best film, which is called Zidane, Portrait of the 21st Century, by a friend of mine, French artist Philippe Parreno and Douglas Gordon. In many ways, what's changed in football, it could be seen in those two films. On the one hand, you've got George Best in his red Manchester United shirt. There's not even a Manchester United emblem on it. There's nothing, no badge, no sponsorship, nothing. You know, you compare that to Zidane, his whole body is covered in Adidas, Adverts, Siemens, you know, everything else that Real Madrid is sponsored by. So there's a difference there. Zidane is a kind of commodified spectacle, but there's a similar beauty in terms of the way in which a body moves. And this allows, you know, very sophisticated thoughts to be had. So, for example, one thing I like to think about is that philosophers for the last 100 years at least have been trying to, at least since Bergson, have been trying to make the case that the physicist's experience of time, the linear time, the time of the clock, the one, two, three, four, the seconds and the minutes, this experience of time is not fundamental. Or it's not the only experience of time. There's the experience of time as lived, the lived experience of time. And that time can move fast, it can move slowly. Philosophers have been trying to make this point in their texts for the last century. But in football, you can see it. You can see time accelerate and decelerate. There's a particularly engaging passage of play, something's happening on the pitch, a goal is scored, a flare lights up in the stadium. That experience of time is accelerated incredibly fast. And then, say, for example, the end of a game, when you're 1-0 up and you try to defend against a team that's coming back at you, time drags. So time, as it were, it contracts and it distends. And you can see that. And you see that time is also intrinsically linked to space in that experience. So these kind of quite complex philosophical thoughts about the lived experience of time and space are something we witness day to day watching a football match. So it's a good introduction to philosophy.
Simon Critchley there on how football helps us understand time. Nathaniel van der Heuvel has a very different but every bit as productive use for the game. The Dutch philosopher has been studying football in the Netherlands, more particularly working with the national team and many of the women who played in this year's World Cup final, using the philosophy of play to see if there aren't possibilities for human flourishing that football may be able to access.
I've had more or less some sort of a career in classical ballet, which is quite a bit different than football. As an object of study, I find football extremely interesting, and it also has to do with the fact that I'm actually quite ignorant when it comes to football and the whole culture or football culture, but that makes it also very exciting to be exploring this field and doing research on it as some sort of an outsider. And I think that you sort of notice different things when you're not so much engaged with a game.
What you've been doing is, you come from a philosophical background, but what you've been doing is kind of a sociological approach to football.
That's true to a certain extent. I've done ethnographic field work, so that means that I've been doing quite a lot of interviews with elite women's football players, precisely those players that are currently playing at the national team or the Dutch national team, but also players that could be considered like the pioneers of Dutch and also Belgium women's football. And on the basis of all that empirical material, I am developing a new philosophical framework to think about subjectivity and agency and freedom. And that is something that I find extremely exciting, in a sense that most philosophers do not really leave the ivory tower. And I do think, at least for myself, that philosophy should always be engaged with the real world. So what I'm interested in from a pure philosophical perspective is the question of the subjectivity of the subject. And that sounds quite abstract, but in very concrete terms, what I mean with this is that we all as Western subjects are kind of, actually we are the product of all sorts of discourses that we are surrounded with. Now, an example could be that I really think that I, as a woman, can really become happy, fulfilled, and successful by buying anti-wrinkle cream. So I really believe that buying into this beauty myth allows me to become a successful person. Now, what this concrete example means is that I have very limited options to sort of create my life according to my own wishes and ambitions. If we are so disciplined, is there some sort of a possibility for freedom still possible? For me, that philosophical question could be addressed by looking at elite women's football. They have to make a lot of sacrifices, women football players, particularly when it comes to health, financial security, social life. And in addition, they have to fight all these kind of gender norms. But what I noticed when I was doing all these interviews is that when it comes to the sacrifices people make in sports, or these women football players make, is that they could not really make sense of why they precisely make those sacrifices. More or less, reason left them when trying to explain why they would make all those sacrifices. So football is some sort of a sphere that transcends real life thoughts and motives. Philosophy of play allows me to understand we do not only act as subjects according to real life thoughts and motives, but also according to the rules of play, according to what could be called the play world. Our capacity to attribute value or attribute meaning to something that we do not believe has meaning allows for a certain form of freedom. A project I recently got engaged with, a project called Multiform, which is basically an intervention, a designed intervention within regular PE classes, where by way of outfits and clothes, normal football play or any other game, are sort of queered with the hope of having kids reflect in a very embodied way about power structures, about their identity and things like that. This designer I work with, he designed outfits, multi-layered outfits. And the whole idea is that during a regular soccer game or a basketball play, the kids involved sort of change their outfits all the time. And so with changing their outfits, they also change the team to which they belong. And that makes them hopefully think about what belonging entails. Who is my enemy? Who is my opponent? Who am I in relation to the prior group to which I belonged? So the whole idea is to make primary school kids think in a very embodied way about identity, about what it means to belong to something, to someone else, or what does it mean to have an enemy. So it's really on a very embodied way that we try to make these kids reflect on very big societal issues. How many kids at a primary school are afraid of PE classes? I mean, a lot, right? Quite a discriminatory practice, I would say. It's almost impossible not to be critical on regular sporting practices. But nevertheless, we can change the organization of sports. But it's really up to us. And it's really up to what sort of society we want to live in. Do we want to tell our kids that being competitive is all that counts? Or do we want to tell them something different? Do we want to want them to explore their body in different ways? Or allow all kids to explore their bodies instead of just the privileged few? So there's much room for improvement, but it's up to us.
Nathania van der Heuvel there on some of football's unexploited possibilities. Another of those unexploited possibilities is to read football as poetry, which was what Ridvan Askin's contribution to the art of soccer did, with a touch-by-touch analysis of some of the game's celebrated goals, such as Diego Maradona's World Cup goal against England in 1986. But when we met, Askin began by telling Culturefile about his route to full-grown soccer academic.
First of all, you know, when we started it, I just sort of organized a conference and had to curate panels, basically. And back then, I had no idea that the aesthetics of football was one of my research fields. So that's just how it turned out afterwards. Really just thinking of it in terms of, I'm a soccer fan. If I want to work on this, how can I bring this into the academic context? So the only thing I can, you know, really talk about or where I have some expertise is the field of aesthetics. So let's put these together. Also, because back then, I thought there isn't that much on the aesthetics of football out there. There's a lot on the sociology, the politics, politically inclined cultural studies work on football, but not that much on the aesthetics of football.
So you are here today to talk about poetry and soccer and the relationship between them. Everybody is familiar with the idea that that is the beautiful game. So maybe people are kind of comfortable with the idea that there is this sort of intrinsic aesthetic quality to football. But maybe they don't understand that as poetry.
Mourinho once said that there are lots of poets in football, but they don't win any titles. So this, it's at least been used metaphorically, referring to a certain style of play and a certain style of player. So I'm linking it up to that. And there have been other people talking about the poetry and poetics of soccer, like already in 1971, Pier Paolo Pasolini wrote a little newspaper article on the poetry of football, saying that in terms of style of play, that we can actually distinguish between more prose style playing and poetic style playing. So I'm picking up on these things and talking about the poetry of football in that sense. What I would describe as a particularly poetic kind of play is a kind of play that disrupts or the flow or the rhythm of the game in a creative way, speeding up, accelerating, a surprising pass. It has to have a moment of surprise that might set up an opportunity for scoring or leads to such a setting up. And those, I would say, are the poetic moments of the game. Can be dribbles, right? Can be certain passes. Can be certain movements through space, you know, just creating space for another player on your team, these kind of things. The point for me is all about rhythm, because what I'm getting at is really just this type of functional distinction that you have organized, systematic game or game plan, and then you have a certain rhythm, and then you have disruptions of rhythm, right? And it's those disruptions that I would call are the poetic moments of the game. Just to give you a concrete example, I mean, for the talk today, I thought about, okay, so Maradona's second goal against England in 1986 World Cup. I then really tried to see, okay, so what are the moves he's doing? Do we have terminology to describe them? What exactly happens? Maradona gets the ball, does a Marseille turn, passes English defenders, and then it's bodily swerves with which he overcomes the opponents. Then obviously acceleration and speed is much faster than his the opponent's players. And then also the audacity to actually make these moves. You know, that's something you need to be prepared to do. Not everyone does that. Yeah, those are, you know, I'd say the major ingredients in that for that particular goal.
having gone down this line, has it changed the way you watch football?
I mean, it certainly changes the way I watch football when I know that I'm watching, when I'm mining scenes that might be useful for the paper. And that's not something that I would have done otherwise. And I say, okay, pinpointing, okay, this is the Marseille turn and this is a particular Buddley swerve and it's that trick and that trick. You just enjoy that he's overcoming the defense, but you don't necessarily look for proper terms to capture certain situations or certain moves. That's what's changed. Making an argument in a paper, you need to be able to precisely pinpoint what you're talking about, and that's what these terms are used for.
Rid van Asken there, co-editor of The Aesthetics, Poetics and Rhetoric of Soccer. And after all that football, how about some furniture? Architect-turned-woodturner Alan Meredith's love of wood began on his family's farm in Mount Melick, a place appropriately named The Oak. Ever since, he's been deepening his admiration and his arsenal of skills and techniques for working with wood, from turning to fuming, steaming, bending and chiselling, all the while trying to understand the unique qualities each piece of wood possesses. Culturefile's Aoife Gallagher went to visit Alan at The Oak, where he now has his studio and workshop.
So really we're trying to find the shape within the piece that we've bent. So we've bent the piece of wood and then we refine it by the hands-on drawing on the wood. Sometimes there might be a crack or a knot or something in the wood that would direct the shape. Okay. The way, because we're using big pieces of oak. That's kind of unpredictable in a way, but then that's kind of nice because it means you have to work with what you get through the process.
So my name is Alan Meredith, and I'm from County Laois, a rural town called Mount Melick, and I'm a furniture maker, wood turner, and I trained as an architect in UCD. And once I graduated, I set up a studio on the family farm where we make three strands of work: vessels, furniture, and installations for public spaces. The focus is on Irish hardwoods and how they might be used within those three disciplines, and how work might be designed in such a way that it takes best advantage of the material.
What is it about wood as a material that you've been drawn to for so many years?
It's something to do with its tactility and the actual density of the material and the texture of it, but also then it's got a similar kind of life to humans, so it's a little bit longer maybe, but like a tree might grow to be 100 to 500 years old. And it stays in the one place. There's a mystery about it. It's been here, I suppose, in our distant memory. So like our grandparents would have known the tree, and maybe our great-grandchildren would know the same tree. And each piece is different and it's got variety. It's alive. I have been drawn to oak. Not quite sure why. I know in terms of turning, it's got a great strength for the steam bending and making of those vessels. It seems like the most suitable material for that. So maybe they have come from the material, or I've made them in a certain way because of the material I've been using, but whichever way it is, I guess it doesn't really matter. Also, the finishes in terms of the colouring, so you could use oak, has got a high tannin content, so that means it can be fumed with ammonia, which gives it a rich brown colour, or it can be ebonized with iron oxide, which makes it black. So they're both natural colourings that can be done with quite simple chemicals that react with the oak. So it's a natural process that gets the finish. And then also, because of the high tannin content, it's really good for using outdoors. So the public space pieces I would have made would be all in oak as well, simply because it's going to last. Like it'll have a lifespan outside for at least 30 years, maybe longer. So it's got a permanence. When it's been turned, it can be used in quite a fluid manner. It's quite a nice material to turn. And then it is the native tree for Ireland and also the name of my home place. So it seems to just have everything going for it, to be honest.
Craft in general in Ireland is not always taken seriously as a fine art.
Certainly, but then I suppose there's lots of craft that's not fine art. And so we have to be careful. We can, you know, where's the line? Who knows?
The two strands within your practice, you have these decorative vessels and you have the furniture, and you consider them separate practices.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose in terms of one thing for sure is the simple function. That's not really enough, because my chairs are hand carved and hand sculpted, and we think about them as a form. Okay, they're comfortable, but the form is the real driver at this stage anyway. The line and the shape and the finish and the texture, that's really what we're exploring rather than the function of the piece, I think. In terms of the vessels aren't functional. They're exhibited on a plinth and they're collected by somebody for their artistic merit as opposed to anything else. So it is what it is. But so where's the line between... If that line is blurry, that's the truth of the matter, yeah. I suppose, I would just hope to just blur it even more.
Today, I feel like pleasing you more than before. Today, I know what I want to do.
Alan Meredith there, turning, fuming, steam bending and chiselling in the company of Culture File's Áine Gallagher. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more closely observed pastimes next Friday at 7. Till then, bye now.